that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to may recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of the great world. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA Safety Card and Safety in AA, Our Common Welfare. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept
the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Elizabeth will read the steps.
Hi, Mr. Alcohol.
Hey, Elizabeth.
We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, but our lives have become unmanageable. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, we humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. Eight, we made a list of all persons we harmed and became willing to make amends for them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Elizabeth. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. All of our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all of our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Tyler.
Hey, I'm Tyler. Sorry for being a little late. I'm actually from Maine, small town up in Maine, so I got all turned around. I was down by Fenway Park. I was everywhere. But, you know, I'll qualify a little bit real quick. I'm actually from a town called Peru, Maine. The population is like 1,400. So, you know, it's a little different down here for me, but, you know, I'll qualify, you know. I spent a lot of years in addiction. You know, and I tried everything. Geographical change, you know, I strong-willed tried doing it on my own, but none of that just ever worked for me. You know, I've been all over the country, not to rehabs, but just to change where I was. You know, but I was a big one, you know, like, I just always thought I could do it on my own, and you know, it was probably 4 years ago. I went to a detox, and I went to this place up in New Hampshire, you know, and that's where I was first introduced to the steps. And I mean, when I first got there, it was like, I walked in at lunchtime, and they were all saying a prayer, and I'm like, what did I get myself into here? But you know, I weren't there long, and I noticed there was something different about the people there. And that's where I was introduced to the steps. And, you know, that it worked for me, but, you know, I was there about 40 days, and, you know, I got feeling good and stuff, and then it become the time that, to leave, and they're like, oh, you're gonna go to sober living now, and I was like, oh, no, you guys don't understand, like, I'm different from these people, I got a house, I'm going home, And they're like, oh, we really wouldn't recommend that. But, you know, taking my will back, I went home. And it weren't long that, you know, I was back into the drinking and drugging and stuff. And I stayed out there for a few more years. But, you know, somebody told me once, you know, when you're in there trying to get better, your addiction's out there doing push-ups. And that was a fact. I picked up right where I left off. And it got bad quick. You know, I was to the point that nobody wanted to be around me. You know, nobody wanted to do nothing to do with me. They just pretty much had given up because, you know, I'd let so many people down so many times. You know, and, you know, I lost a cousin that was close to me. We were like brothers. I lost him to an overdose. And, you know, I stayed out there for another year, but it was time. And this time I come into it, and I didn't do a rehab. I went to a detox. And from the detox, I went to sober living. And that was a big thing for me because, like, I needed a little bit of freedom, but at the same time, I needed structure. And, you know, I continued on. That's where I started the steps again, went through the steps, wrote a thorough four-step and read it and stuff. And, you know, then I was at this first house for, like, 9 months, and it was good. Like, I learned a lot at that house, but I felt stagnant because I really wasn't giving back to other people yet, and that's where I felt like I was ready to do. And so I was approached at a meeting to come to somebody else's house and be a manager for them. So I agreed, and because when I first come down here, I said I'll go for 6 months. I've been down here for a year and a half now. You know, and life I just keep getting better and better. You know, as far as my recovery, you know, my life itself's getting better. You know, I got a 9-month-old son at home, and it's hard being away. But when I go home on the weekends and stuff like that, it's that much sweeter. And, you know, I grew up with a mother that was an alcoholic, and she's still an alcoholic. You know, I've tried showing her a few times, but, you know, as we all know, unless you want to get better, you're not going to get better. And, but, you know, I always told myself if I ever had a kid that I would never let that kid know me an addiction. And so far, I've done that. You know, it's one day at a time, but I'm working to make that goal come true. A big thing for me this time around, I call it God. You can call it what you want, your higher power and stuff. But, you know, I do a Bible study. I do that type of stuff. And you know, I get on my knees every morning and every night and pray. And it's what works for me. I mean, you know, I just continue to do this work. And, you know, lately I've been sponsoring guys. And that's real rewarding for me, you know, because you see these guys that are coming in completely broken. And it's like, wow, I was there not long ago. And I could go right back to that place if I don't keep doing this work and doing the things that help me. And, you know, it's just been an awesome journey. Thanks, Brian, for asking me to speak tonight. It was really awesome. You know, I ain't big on this type of stuff because I don't like speaking in front of people. You know, like, this room is probably bigger than my graduating class. So, you know, it's a little bit different for me. But, you know, it's about doing the things that are uncomfortable. And it makes me uncomfortable, but after I'll feel a lot better about it. And, you know, thanks for having me.
We will now observe the seventh tradition. AA's has no dues or fees for AA membership, but we do have expenses. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. AA's usual suggestion is a $2 contribution per meeting. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the Seven Tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Again, although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $400 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individuals. Apply to the individual. Tonight, Jimmy has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jimmy.
Jimmy.
The 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facilities or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contribution. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service center may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relation policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Jimmy. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting, which meets on the third Wednesday of each month at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in hybrid format, both here at St. Paul's Church and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? Thank you. And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Jules.
I'm Jules, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jules.
Oh, it feels good to say that. I haven't been able to say that in 7 days out loud to a group of other alcoholics, so it's just good to be here. My sobriety date is April 11, 2016. I have a sponsor who I talk about God with, and I'm working the steps. I'm on step 4 right now, again. I do service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a higher power, which I choose to call whatever I want, depending on how I feel in that moment. Those are the tools that have kept me sober today. That's what I heard other people saying when I first came in. I am so grateful that when I went to my first meeting, there was three other people there. It was a beginner's meeting. I thought you needed to go to a beginner's meeting to go to a regular meeting because you needed to learn how to do the ropes or whatever, like how CrossFit sometimes they have that. And I went, and the person who was chairing the meeting, I still see all the time, and gave me my first big book, and it's a miracle. And I identified with what he was talking about. He said that he would get drunk and go home and watch TV and try to remember certain episodes in the TV show that he was watching. And so he would prove to himself in the morning that he wasn't that drunk. And I used to do that. I used to do it years before I actually finally came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to do it with the nanny. It would be on at like 2 in the morning, and I'd be home from the bar, and I'd be like, I'm going to remember this episode. It's so funny. And then... like, I identified with that, and that was the first thing that pulled me in, is I was like, damn, this guy, like, excuse me, that guy drinks, you know, like, whatever. He feels the way that I feel. And then he gave me a big book and told me to go home and read more about alcoholism, because I did not know what alcoholism was. I didn't know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. All I knew was that I couldn't stop drinking once I started. And I thought that maybe I just couldn't control it. There was a lot of reasons why I didn't think I was like as bad as you guys, or like whatever I thought alcoholics were. But all of that got taken out of my brain when I went to my first meeting, and I can't attribute that to anything other than a power greater than myself, because there was a lot of reasons that I just thought, I'm like fine, I just like do a little too hard on the weekends. And so when I came here and they told me, he told me to read more about alcoholism, and that second page where it talks about how we tried to control our drinking, every single line. And I just remember sobbing, being like, this is my problem. Like, this is what it is. And identifying with that literature was so important to me that regardless of like the people I was at the meeting with it that day, I could go home and read this book. And it told me how I felt about myself. And that was like within the first 2 minutes of reading this book. So I kept coming back. They say, keep coming. We say, keep coming. I say, keep coming. And I feel like today what that means for me is, I don't know what message I'm gonna get or how it's gonna be go into my brain or what vessel it's gonna come through. But the more that I keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in whatever capacity that is, whether it's meetings, whether it's meeting with sponsees, whether it's meeting with my sponsor, talking to another alcoholic before or after a meeting or service events, I hear things that I don't normally hear. And they resonate in my brain in a way that like cools the fire of gripping. I have this feeling of a fist on my esophagus, and that's how I felt for 26 years before I picked up a drink. I felt I had the bedevilments at 5 years old in kindergarten. Like I could identify with that, but I didn't know that when I came in. I didn't come into my first meeting and say like, in kindergarten I was really anxious, now I drink a lot. Like I get to learn all of like what my alcoholism looks like. And today I feel like, yeah, I have this neutrality around alcohol. It is an absolute miracle. It's an absolute miracle. End of sentence. But then there's like this whole other piece that I experienced when I was in kindergarten that I didn't know there was a solution for. That like I didn't understand that other people felt the way that I felt. That they could like go on a gossip spree with coworkers and wake up in the morning and feel that guilt, shame, and remorse. Like I didn't know that other people hated themselves the way that I hated myself. Or that there was something that I could do to live in a world, in this world, regardless of what's going on outside, and have this feeling of serenity or understand what that means, and not have so many problems with my relationships and be a good employee. And today, like, when I get resentments, it's like a fire in my body. Like, I just... And there's resentments that I have had for years and years. And I had an experience this past week where like the same question was asked to me by a different person in a different country, in a different continent. And for whatever reason, the fire didn't erupt. And it was like, I don't even think I noticed until I talked to my sponsor later on. Well, wow, that's a spiritual experience. You know, that I can have a different reaction to something. And again, like, wasn't my idea, wasn't my choice to be like, I'm not gonna get resentful about this specific time. Like, it just happened. And now I can kind of think to myself, what I've been thinking to myself is like, how can that apply to like other areas in my life? And that is basically my experience with the steps, is that I have been restored to sanity because I know that I can't take a drink. It doesn't matter if it's organic wine, doesn't matter like if it's something that's gonna, things I just don't do, I don't get angry about it now. Somebody just asked me, like, you don't drink because you're Jewish? And I was like, no, that's not why. That's why I don't eat shellfish, but not why I don't drink. You know, like, it's, and I don't get mad. I don't have to get mad about it anymore. But sometimes I do. You know, it depends on the day, I guess, and who it's coming from. I guess I don't get mad at the fact that I can't drink. And I was really nervous about that when I came in. I was like, my life is gonna suck. Like, I'm just basically gonna have to quit my job. I'm gonna have to move from Boston. I'm gonna have to just redo my entire life. And I was willing to do that. I was like so desperate. I just couldn't do it anymore. I could not deal with the self-hatred. I couldn't deal with just how I kept saying that I was gonna control it and how, like, the controlling of, you know, what I was doing to manage just the drinking piece of it was just exhausting. And I had no idea that, like, once that kind of went away and I did the steps, which restored sanity and started helping other people and getting outside myself, all of a sudden, like, there's other stuff. Oh my God. Like, this was this there all along. And it's still there, but I have, you know, the tools to deal with it now. And so this idea of neutrality around, like, whatever it is, whether it's alcohol, whether it's these questions that really bother me, or it's just like an annoying coworker, whatever it is, like, I now have proof, I have evidence that I can have something different. And the baseline is that I am neutral around alcohol today. And it, you know, if I'm not feeling great or whatever, and I have to go somewhere where I'm around it, I haven't experienced that. I know it says, like, we shouldn't go anywhere if we're not spiritually fit. So I think about that before I'm going places. But I had to go to, like, weddings in early sobriety where my sponsor was like, you call me every half hour, you call this girl every other 10 minutes, you call that girl every other 10 minutes. And that's what I did. And, like, nothing that I do here is because I thought it was a good idea. It's because it's what somebody else said that they do, and they're here and okay, or look like, you know, they're like, okay, living life. And I'm like, oh, I'll try it. Like, I heard someone say that they had a resentment and they sat down and they breathed until it was cooled off. And it took them 45 minutes. And I was like, wow, that's cool. I'm going to try that. And I tried that one time and it worked. So now that's another tool that I get that, like, again, if I didn't come to meetings or, like, talk to other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't know what these things are. I can't think them up by myself. Our literature is fantastic, but talking to another person about how they deal with it with their life on a day-to-day basis continues to blow my mind whenever I connect with another alcoholic. So yeah, I am, like, this between sponsorship, meetings, other alcoholics, trying to make myself available whenever somebody needs it, and doing service, like, I'm now in, my higher power has created this network for me that, like, it's really hard for me to break out of. And I'm so grateful for it. And I'm going to hold on to it because I'm just going to hold on to it for today because anyways, I'm grateful to be here. Thanks.
Thank you, Jules. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Romero, after the meeting. And now let's welcome our main speaker, George.
Hello, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name is George.
Hi, George.
And I was grateful to be here. I haven't been here in a long time. Well, I was here a couple of weeks ago because my buddy Fitzy was speaking, and it was really nice to see folks. For anybody who doesn't know me, I've been I'm an old guy, and my story is one of a young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was young when I got here. So I'm from Boston, and I grew up in Jamaica Plain. I come from a family where there was no alcohol allowed in my house because my mom, unbeknownst to me, my mom had alcoholism in her family. My grandparents were alcoholic. I never knew that until long after they died. So there was some alcoholism in my family that I wasn't aware of. And there was no alcohol in my house, but I did see it in my extended family, and I certainly saw it a lot in my neighborhood. But I wasn't drawn to that as a child. As a child, I was drawn to that. I wanted to play the role of the good kid, the best kid in the world. I wanted to get good grades and be a good kid and have everybody like me. And all my cousins, you know, my family is completely plagued with addiction, so all my cousins were already, like, in trouble, getting arrested, you know, having babies when they shouldn't and all that stuff. And I wanted to be the good kid. I wanted to, like, you know, play that role of the, you know, the white sheep in a really bad family. And I did, was able to pull that off for just a few years. And then I came across an experience where I was given medication for a medical condition. I had really bad asthma, really bad breathing problems and respiratory problems. So I was given drugs in the 60s for respiratory problems were pretty much just speed. And I was given a ton of medications that, you know, if I took them as prescribed, I breathed better, but if I took more than prescribed, Batman was really fun to watch. So I got the idea that I could feel better than how I felt by taking substances. And then the whole idea of drinking became very, very intriguing. And around the time that I started sort of thinking of the idea of getting drunk, I was brought into a wedding. I think I was like 10. And I was able to run around and grab all the drinks off the tables. And tried alcohol for the first time by myself, got sick, threw up, fell down. And that was it. I was in love, you know. And that was, I didn't drink. I didn't have a compulsion to drink again the next day. I just knew that I filed that away. It's like, that is something I'm going to do every opportunity. And I did. And the alcohol took me. It took the advantage that it needed, and my disease started to take control. And as I said, I was getting good grades, being a good person, and essentially just trying to live my life as a good person. And alcoholism, the disease itself, started to speak to me and told me that it wasn't worth it. Other people having much more fun. See those kids over there with the anchor bracelets? They're really having a good time. And I made a very conscious decision when I was 14, or probably about 14, that I was all done with the being good thing, and then I gave everything over to alcohol, gave everything over to my disease, and the first year of my sophomore year of high school. I disappeared for the first time. I went out drinking with a bunch of people, after a bunch of young kids, and they were all runaways from different parts of the world that were all living in the Boston Common. And they said, you don't have to go home. So we stayed out, and I stayed out for 3 days. So I disappeared as a teenager in high school for 3 days, and my parents didn't know where I was. And when I showed up at home, I didn't understand why they were so mad. And it progressed from there. And by 17, I was already doing that thing that I don't know, maybe not everybody does this, but a lot of us did. I was talking to the booze. I was drinking and talking to, like, why can't I quit you? I was talking to the booze, like, this is not good. This is getting worse. It's getting worse all the time. We gotta stop this, you know. I just continued to, and it also there was a personality change, because the spiritual loss of value for me was immediate, and I was dishonest. The dishonesty led to everything else. It started this whole cycle of just, like, being dishonest led to this shame, and the shame led me to try to be more arrogant, and my arrogance turned into anger and resentment. I just blamed everyone. I blamed my parents, who were doing their best to try to hold my life together, and alcohol had me. So I came home. I did another, like, two-nighter, and came home, and my key didn't fit in the door anymore. And I had to leave. My mom told me that I had a choice of not drinking or leaving, and I just packed a little bag and left, at 17 and still in high school. And I found that I found that spiritual loss of values led to me. I had no idea what it cost to buy food or to, like, I didn't know how to do laundry. I had none of those things. I was just a kid. And I didn't know that you needed money. Well, I knew you needed money to live, and I just thought that that would come, and it didn't come, and I had to make it happen. And, you know, I found that I didn't need, I went to bars where there were lots of nice older gentlemen with very deep pockets, and I was taken care of, and I only had to pay with my dignity. And I started the circuit of prostituting, gay bars, and at that time I just knew that the line that you cross where you cannot go back was way behind me. It was already gone, and God would never love me. My parents would never take me back. There was nothing left worthwhile. I was dirty from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. There was nothing left, and I could never rejoin the daywalkers. That's what I called you guys, you know, the people that were awake in the daytime and, like, you know, had credit cards with their own name on it, you know, that kind of thing. So I really just wanted to die. And the miracle for me came as after several years of being homeless and living on the street, and I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time by a cousin. My cousin Linda was a couple years older than me. She was an absolute dumpster fire. and her life, she actually, hers was actually worse than mine, if you can believe that. And and she called me. You know, she called my mom and my dad and said, you know, if George ever needs help, tell him to call me. And my dad said, well, you know, he's gone. He doesn't live here anymore, but he still hangs out with his friend Robin. And Linda called Robin, and Robin told me, Cousin Linda wants to talk to you. And I called her, and she said, I'm going to an AA meeting tonight. I joined AA. I'm sober for 6 months. And we have a lot of fun. We do great things, and staying sober is wonderful. And it was absolute nonsense. It just made no sense to me. I'm like, no. There's absolutely no way that I can live without drinking. It's not going to happen. I tried it. I couldn't even slow down. Never mind stop. And she kept at me for a couple of days, and after a couple of days of trying to track me down, she found me, and she brought me to my first AA meeting. And I had been to AA meetings before, because in downtown Boston, all the places that I ran around and entertained people, I was in a lot of that downtown area where there were a lot of churches. And when you're running from the cops, when you're hanging out on the street corner and the cops come by, or you know, you find out that somebody has vice, you just run, and you run into the first place that's open, and church basements were always open, and there were a couple of AA meetings down around Arlington Street, down Park Square. And so I had been inside AA meetings, and I saw a book, and I saw blue and gold banners. So it was like church and Boy Scouts together, I guess. And anybody that had a book, to me, was a little sus. So I was not down for the book or the manners, and I kind of had my mind made up that AA was this, like, religious thing, you know. But she convinced me that there were boys there, so I was like, all right, I'll check it out. And we went to a dance. We went to the New Boston Group in Dorchester at BC High. And that date, by the way, was July 10th of 1980, and that is my sobriety date. I've changed everything else but that. And I went to my first AA meeting, and I met people, and they talked to me. And the immediate thing that struck me about Alcoholics Anonymous was, when I talked to people, my tendency was to look at the floor or to look at, you know, avert my eyes, because no one ever wanted to make eye contact with me. And people seemed to want to make eye contact with me, and they talked directly to me. And they wanted me to come back the next week, and they had a book that had people's names in it, and I signed the book, and I said, well, I'll come back next week. And what I didn't know was that there were A meetings every day, And every single day for the next week, some fat old guy with gray hair would show up at my cousin's door or my parents' door and say, "Where's the kid?" And he'd say, "Send the kid out. Get in the car." And I'd get in the car, and the fat old guy would go in and talk to my parents. And he snitched on me. He told them everything. He said, "Don't let him use the phone. Don't let him go out. If he's got a little bike book or an address book, get it, take it away from him." You know, and he totally ratted me out to my parents about all the things that, if he says he's going to a meeting, don't believe it unless he's going with me. You know, totally killed my buzz. And I got sober. So long story short, I got sober, and I didn't drink. And the third night that I went to my third meeting with the Hank the Crank, the old guy, actually, that was his name. Everyone had a stupid nickname back then. So Hank the Crank picked me up to take me to a meeting, and I threw up in his car. I was withdrawing. I was sick. And then this little old lady named Judy gave me a ride back to Dorchester the next Friday. And the guys didn't want me in the car. So Judy picked me up, and I had a flashback. I did a lot of acid. And I had a flashback in the car. And she didn't even know what acid was. So I really frightened a lot of these old people. And my choice of outfits was probably pretty scary too. But I got sober, and I shaked and I rattled and I rolled, and people fed me ice cream and bought me food and took me to meetings like we used to do in the old days, you know, the old times. And I joined that group. And Judy told me about, you know, says, "Well, if you want to meet some more people like you, I thought she meant gay. She meant young. So I was like, "Oh." So she sent me to meetings where there were other young people downtown. And I joined the New Commonwealth group and a few other meetings. And I started getting sober. And I didn't look for a sponsor. I didn't want to do the programming thing. I just wanted to do the fun stuff. So I avoided the programming thing. And then a sponsor came up and handed me, not the big one, believe it or not, he gave me these 12 Hazelden pamphlets that were the guides to the 12 steps. And it was one little booklet for each step. It was weird. So but it was my introduction to the 12 steps. And it was mostly literature from the big book anyway. So I filled out his little pamphlets, and I would give them back to him, and he would read them with me. And I continued to go to meetings. I continued to get a little bit better. I made some better choices. Yeah. And after a couple of years of being taken care of, I was able to work again. I was able to find a job, and I started that life that you see around here, where, you know, you begin to pick up the pieces and you start to realize that, you know, that there is an intrinsic value just in you, even if you don't get sober, your humanity gives you worth. And so I figured that out because people told me, and I read it in this, you know, in these books and in this literature. So I changed a lot of the perceptions that I had of myself and the world around me from that, and I continued to move forward. I was recruited very, very young into service. I was a kid, so I got, you know, an old guy named Norman, who answered the phones at Central Service, recruited me to go with him on a public information assignment to a high school, because he figured that, you know, the kids would identify. They clocked me the second I walked in the door, but, you know, but it was actually an amazing introduction that I had something to offer. I didn't have to be a sponsor. I didn't have to like take me through the steps yet, but I could still be of service and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I joined the Public Relations Committee, started to do service, started to join other groups, and my story, there's a lot, and it's just like amazing things, one after the other after the other, peppered in between with really horrible things. Last weekend, I spent a couple of days at a friend's house because he and his fiance had a roommate who was in AA, and you know, and he's in recovery, she's not, and they had a roommate in recovery, and he relapsed, and it was really bad, it was really ugly, and it was violent, And he needed people to be there to protect him and his girlfriend in their home from this guy. And we sat vigil, you know, like five or six of us stayed at his house, and we always made sure there were at least a couple of guys there to stay in his house. So it was, if the, when this guy came, we got a restraining order on Monday, but, you know, during the weekend, we had to keep his girlfriend, his fiance safe. And so we stayed at the house, and, you know, and I was talking to her, and I looked at the, and I, you know, I was talking to her, and she was shaking, and she was really traumatized. And it was very hard for me to look at, because that is what we do to people. That is what we do. That is what I did. I did that to my parents. I did that to the teachers at school to try to help me. I did that to the street workers that used to try to help me when I was homeless. And I traumatized everybody. I had a personality change when I drank that was unfathomable. I just can't imagine. I still can remember some of the things I said to people and the things I did to people. And I don't feel shame anymore. The shame is long gone. But I still have, you know, I still know what that guilt feels like. You know, the guilt is still convenient. I like the guilt. The shame I don't hold on to. But the guilt is good because it reminds me that I'm still capable of great wrong. And I'm human. So this weekend was a really difficult thing to sit through. Seeing it, you know, because he kept coming back and the police kept taking him out. So we do great harm, and there's it's not unusual. It's not a surprise to me that a lot of us don't get sober, that people just can't face life without alcohol. I don't understand why, because that's a lot of pain to carry around, and alcoholism does a lot of damage. I just wanted to say that. And the other part of this is that shortly after joining some groups and having, you know, getting my first year, my second year, my third year, I wanted more. I wanted to get some of the joy that I saw in the people that were older and people that were sober for a while and doing great things. I wanted some of the joy. I was good with the comfort, but I wanted the joy. And someone said, well, come with me. And we went to a meeting where they were going through the big book, like line by line, reading it, going through it, and taking people through the steps out of the big book. And I joined that group, and I got a sponsor there, and I went through the steps out of the big book for the first time. And another whole level of awesomeness was opened up for me, you know. And actually more pain and more difficult stuff, because, you know, the more I looked at my actual character defects and told myself the truth, the harder that was to look at sometimes. You know, it's a package deal. You can't get all the good stuff without, you know, the painful stuff. And you have to walk through all the discomfort. So I started going through the steps, and I made it a point to go through the steps every year with my sponsor. Became active in service beyond the group level, working with the area, started conventions. And that was another big part of my recovery, was going to conferences and conventions. I know there's it's a mixed, you know, AE, either love them or you hate them. But for me, I liked the glow that happened when I went to one. So I did the conferences, I did the conventions, and I also want to just say, you know, I mean, I had along the way, you know, when you first come in, well, a lot of us, when we first come into AA, we get that little crew, we get that little posse, and we're running together, and we're going to stay sober forever, we're going to just be going to meetings and sponsoring people, it's going to be great. And then one of them relapsed. And then, you know, or one of them dies, or one of them moves away and disappears. And you have to start getting that black suit up and going to funerals. One of the first guys, Tommy Mack, guy from Fields Corner, told me, kid, if you're going to be one of us, you're going to need a good black suit, because you're going to be going to a lot of funerals. You know, and if you don't do what we do, we'll have something to bury you in. And he was right. So I went to a lot of funerals, and I buried sponsees. I buried a couple of sponsors. My grand sponsor relapsed last year after 29 years. 29 years over. You know, so it's you know, it's a mixed bag here. You know, we you have to take the good with the bad. Some other things that I opened myself up to in recovery were changing some things, some concepts I had about myself, about who I was and what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. And at one point, there was an opportunity to take in my sponsee's children because he relapsed and his kids were going into foster care. Parent was not on that list of things to be for a lot of reasons. And I said yes to that opportunity, and it was it's been amazing. It was wonderful. It was a lot of people in this room probably have met my kids and seen them, you know, they're the children of two alcoholics who both committed suicide and addiction, and they both have it. They have this thing, and they're struggling. But they're alive, and they grew up in AA. So this whole, you know, my kids, when they can be drunk off their butt, I'm trying not to swear. They can be drunk as hell, and they can still recite the 12 steps, all 12, in order, exactly. Because they grew up in my house. So, you know, these kids have seen a lot of 12-step calls. So there's always hope. As long as an alcoholic is alive, there's hope. And I pray every day that... They find their way back to this or to something that works for them, whatever that might be. You know, maybe this isn't the answer for them because they absolutely hate AA. But you know, as long as there's love, there's possibilities. Some other things that I could share about my experience with recovery is the service part, because I. For many years, even after I got sober, I woke up every morning fearful, like a lot of us do, just waking up fearful, like afraid the minute my eyes open. You know, all I can think about is what bad things might happen today. You know, that's pretty much my morning routine. And that hasn't been the case since. And I mean, this wasn't something that happened after the first couple of times I did the steps, but again, every time I go through them, I rip up a little bit more of that garbage that's in there, and now when I wake up, the first thing I think of is almost always someone else. The first thing I think of when I wake up, I get a little groggy and I can't know what day it is. When it comes to me what day it is, I think of what meeting I'm going to that day, because that's what I do. So if it's like if I'm half asleep and I'm waking up and it's Tuesday, oh, I'm going to that meeting today. Oh, that new guy was there last week. I hope he's there again today. You know, or, so-and-so's getting the medallion tonight. So that's what I think of when I wake up in the morning. That's my morning. My morning is thinking of other people. And then, like, prayer and meditation. And, you know, in case I forget, I tattooed it on my arm, all the things I have to do every day. You know, prayer, meditation, you know, reading any literature, at least 2 pages. You know, asking for help, using my sponsor, and sharing my recovery with others. So I do those things every day. And it's just the personality, the perspective change is just amazing. I am able to do things like call out sick from work and go sit at someone's house, and maybe, you know, thinking that some drunk guy might come and beat my head in. But I don't know, it just felt like the right thing to do. And the look on my friend's face when he came home and found me sitting on the couch with his fiance, and realized that people had been keeping vigil at his house around the clock for 2 days, until Monday morning the court opened. You know, that doesn't happen in a lot of other places. That really happens here. Some other things I can share about what happens here is that I was in an accident a couple of months ago, and I got hit by a car crossing the street. And I was really badly hurt, and I could not do anything for myself. I mean, literally couldn't do anything for myself. I had multiple broken bones and contusions and blood clots. I'm old, I don't fix quick. And never once did I have to worry about anything. I had food delivered to my door every day. I had rides to all of my appointments. I had people come in just staying at my house. And I had someone that would come over every morning and help me put my socks on. Because I can't. I couldn't do it for myself. And, I mean, where do you get that? Where do you find a fellowship of people who love each other so much that they're willing to sacrifice so much for another person that they don't know that well, you know. That happens here. It doesn't happen anywhere else. I've had the joy of really of meeting people that have been sober a lot longer than me, that have done been doing this step, doing this work, doing this service, doing service for a lot longer than I have. They're out there. You know, come to a world convention, you know, there'll be 150 people on the floor with more than 40 years, you know. And that is what I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to the fellowship and staying in the middle, because, you know, being at the top of AA is kind of a like a myth that doesn't really exist. All there is the middle, because there's always someone handing me what I need, and there's always me trying to give someone else what they need, so I'm always in the middle. And that's what I try to do here. That's what I was taught, and that's what works for me. And I'm pretty sure that that's really what this is all about, is being in the middle, taking what you get here and passing it on without having... And for me, the important thing is not to put my little spin on it. I like doing that sometimes. And I'm running out of stuff to say. That means God's telling me to shut up. And I want to say that if God bothers you, please stay. You know, it's you know, like I said, that the people that leave here because they're, you know, I came here looking for 1,000 reasons to leave, and I had them all. You know, I was this little gay boy hanging out with four-fingered Freddy and, you know, Postman Bob, and, you know, I was getting in people's Dodge Darts to go to Greasy Spoons for coffee after the meeting and hanging out in Charlestown. You know, I had a million reasons to leave, and I stayed. And I stayed regardless of, you know, the book stopped scaring me when I, you know, started to read it and when I started having it explained to me. You know, the words and the language and the names that are up here, the pronouns, all those things, I was able to come to an understanding of those with the help of a sponsor. So I put that effort in because it is worth it. And that's it. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Joey.
Thank you, George. We now have Julia and Chris for festivities.
Hey everyone, my name's Chris, I'm an alcoholic.
Chris.
Julia, alcoholic.
Julia.
So real quick, so the next